Is it Rolling Bob?
Talking Dylan.
He's your host, Lucas Hare.
He's your host, Kerry Shale.
But on the digital Bob phone, she's our guest, NPR music critic, Ann Powers.
A saxophone someplace far off played as she was walking on by the arcade. As the light bust through a beat-up shade where he was waking up, she dropped a coin into the cup of a blind man at the gate and forgot about a simple twist of fate. He woke up. The room was bare. He didn't see her anywhere. He told himself he didn't care, pushed the window open wide, felt an emptiness inside to which he just could not relate, brought on by a simple twist of fate. He hears the ticking of the clocks and walks along with a pair at the talks, hunts her down by the waterfront docks where the sailors all come in. Maybe she'll pick him out again. How long must he wait? One more time for a simple twist of fate. People tell me it's a sin to know and feel too much within. I still believe she was my twin, but I lost the ring. She was born in spring, but I was born too late. Blame it on a simple twist of fate.
Gorgeous. Thank you, Anne. I've got to say, I just love Parrot the Talks. That always there's a joke, you know, even the most serious, beautiful song has a little joke. To me, that's a
absolutely
very funny joke.
It's a joke, but, you know, it's funny because with Dylan, it's all every joke has another meaning and every laugh opens a window. That's a terrible mixed metaphor. Bob Dylan would criticize my poeticism there. But, you know, the idea of the Parrot the Talks, it's like, it connects with the whole history and legacy of Dylan as someone who says that the culture speaks through him, you know, someone who he is his own parrot that talks. And I think in the song Simple Twist of Fate, one of his most personal songs from his arguably one of his most personal albums, Blood on the Tracks, he's, you know, trying to be more direct. But still, as you're saying, he enters into that realm of the poetic almost against his own will.
So why did you choose the song?
I love Blood on the Tracks. And, you know, when I was a kid in high school, that was the album that really made me appreciate Bob Dylan. My very good friend was in love with the redhead, and he felt that Blood on the Tracks had been written for him and her. Not me. I am also a redhead. But and so my best friend in high school, he turned me on to Bob by giving me this record. And I think it is an album that appeals to anyone, even if you're not into kind of the more high-minded side of Dylan, or say even the political side of Dylan, or the old weird America side of Dylan. Here's an album that is about relationships and about one specific relationship. I also currently have been working a lot on, I'm writing a book about Joni Mitchell, and this album was inspired by her album Blue. Some think, and Bob has intimated at times, that the song Tangled Up in Blue is called Tangled Up in Blue because he was tangled up in blue while writing Blood on the Tracks. So those are a couple reasons.
Great, great reasons. I didn't know that. I didn't know that Bob...
Yeah, well, you know, that's the thing about the Martin Scorsese Rolling Thunder documentary that really stuck with so many people, is that scene when Joni, you know, she's joined the tour and she's playing Coyote for them for the first time, but from her masterwork, a 1975 Sajira. And, you know, Dylan is sitting there trying to like figure out what the hell is going on. Like how is she playing? You know, how are her fingers moving on that guitar? What are these amazing words coming out of her mouth? And she's just blowing everybody in the room away, as she does, you know, just by being Joni.
Well, as we're discussing Joni, we are Joni fans, and we don't talk about her really enough on the podcast. It is a Bob podcast. But I read somewhere when I was looking you up on the interweb, a story about how you were giving a paper and Joni Mitchell was sitting in the front row. Can you remind us of that?
Many years ago, Dan Levitin, who writes about, he wrote that book, This Is Your Brain, on music. He's a neuroscientist. And he invited me to a conference at McGill University. They were giving Joni an honorary degree. And this was actually just months after my daughter was born and we adopted her at birth. And it was my first time away from her. And I flew from Seattle, where I was living at the time, to McGill and
in Montreal,
Sorry. And I had total jet lag. Like I was not equipped and I didn't have the right chemicals to help me get to sleep that night. So I was on like hardly any sleep. And I went to this conference and Joni was there and she was there with her daughter who she was, you know, probably know the story. She entrusted her daughter for adoption at birth and they were reunited years later. Anyway, she and Kaloran were there. So I was kind of a wreck and I made it through the conference. Our session was the last of the day. It was me, the critic Greg Tate, the performance artist and conceptual artist John Kelly. And we were all giving different kind of perspectives on Joni's career. And, you know, Greg gave this paper about Joni is like so in touch with Black culture. Greg is like a titan of Black American criticism. And then John, who is a good friend of Joni, you know, so everyone is like singing her praises and everything. And I had written this very personal paper on Blue. And it was structured around every song on Blue. And as you probably know, the song Little Green is about her daughter, Kaloran, who she had named Kelly, and trusting her for adoption. So when I read that passage, I mentioned my daughter, who we had, you know, we have an open adoption with her birth mother. We know her birth mother. And I started crying because, you know, I was away from my daughter. Plus, I was just completely out of it. You know, I was so tired and the pressure of having Joni right in the front row. And so I'm like crying and I'm losing it a little. And suddenly I hear this voice from the front row. You can do it. You can do it. And I'm like, oh, my God. That's Joni Mitchell, like being my mom there for a minute, you know, and I mean, it was such a sweet gesture, but of course I was completely mortified. You can imagine, you know, but I got through the paper. So, and then later I was like, I avoided her at the reception, which I regret. I wish I had thanked her. Instead, I was embarrassed, you know, but, and it, with the wisdom of time, I thank her now.
We just love hearing about Joni because we think she's on an equal plane to Bob. And
I'm glad to hear you say that. That's, you know, I think the world has come around to that. Yeah, oh, she definitely does.
I think she's above Bob, really.
Well, I think she thinks Bob is one of her few peers. Bob, Picasso, Leonard Cohen. There are a few, not very many.
Yeah. Well, should we just maybe talk a little bit about the paper that you wrote that was published in The World of Bob Dylan by Cambridge University Press? But it was also a talk that you gave, I think, in Tulsa.
Yes,
It's called Gender and Sexuality, Bob Dylan's Body.
Well, when Sean Latham invited me to give this talk, and it was a keynote talk at the World of Bob Dylan conference, which was the conference celebrating the birth of this wonderful, amazing center for the study of Bob Dylan and popular music in Tulsa. I thought, okay, this is going to be a real opportunity to talk to people I don't always get to talk to, because Bob Dylan fans, as all of you listeners out there in Dylan land, you know, it's a particular group of extremely educated, erudite, intellectually ambitious, and highly competitive thinkers about Bob Dylan. You know? So I thought, okay, here I am walking into this group. I'm not, I play a Dylanologist a little bit occasionally. Like, you know, in my work, I've written a lot about Bob Dylan over the many years of my career. However, I am not a full-fledged Dylanologist, and I would never pretend to have the knowledge that y'all have. You know, it's just, I'm not a specialist the way that the true Dylan devotees are. So I'm thinking, okay, I'm not going to be able to like go in there and dazzle them with the minutiae in my mind about Dylan and what he did on, like, you know, September 14th, 1967. I don't even know if that's a real date, but you get my point. Also, I, you know, write a lot about gender and sexuality in my work. It's, I guess you call it my specialty. And this is a pretty neglected area in Bob Dylan studies, if we want to call it that. And it's not completely neglected. Barbara O'Dare wrote a great essay about it many years ago. You know, there's others who've written about it. And of course, like Susie Rodolo wrote an amazing book about her time with Bob that deals with a lot of this stuff. But I thought, okay, what can I do that's going to make me the most uncomfortable in this room of like mostly men who know everything about Bob Dylan. I'll talk about Bob Dylan's body. I guess I like a challenge. So I was trying to fill in all seriousness, I was kind of trying to fill a gap, but also I was like responding, I guess, to my own call, my own interest in Dylan, not only as this great brain, and that's kind of how the essay starts out, you know, talking about his enormous head, his enormous brain, the Milton Glaser poster, the very famous image of Dylan with his hair electric. You know, I wanted to say, okay, what's below the neck? Because we never think about that. We never talk about that. And I did it sort of as a provocation and a tease, but a tease to the audience. So like, hey, try thinking in this way. But once I started getting into it, I found this like a fascinating kind of weave of threads moving through his work where he does express desire. He does express physicality in his work. And it was great to kind of like unravel that over time or figure out where that goes.
Well, it's a great paper. And I was most struck at the beginning by, now you say Rotolo.
Oh, yeah, I'd say, oh.
I always say
Rotolo. Here I go, the Dylanologist tells me. I think it's Rotolo, but.
Well, I'll say Rotolo for now. But you talk about that
if
photo.
If I'm saying it wrong, I'm sorry. I'm going to say, never, as an NPR, as working for NPR for almost 10 years now, you just pulled a Bob Boylan on me, my friend, because this always happens to me when I'm recording All Songs Considered with Bob, the founder of NPR Music and All Songs Considered. He's like, I think you pronounced that wrong. Yeah, I live in a one room here. Like, you know, I don't go outside. I only read books. No, I'm kidding. But you know how it is. Like,
no, but I have no idea myself. I thought I was wrong. I just thought from looking at it. Anyway,
well, I'm going to say my agent was her agent on that book, and she pronounces it Rotolo. So.
Oh, great. Well, then it's Rotolo. It's Rotolo from now on. It's definitely Rotolo. So the little paragraph that you wrote about Dylan wearing his Buddy Holly glasses and leaning into Susie Rotolo and with his arms over.
Adorable
lesbian couple. And I looked at that picture and I thought, you totally nailed it. Because you're making the point that is, I think, is it soft Bob? The first body that he had, or his body of work as well, you're talking about.
Yes, completely. Well, you know, I mean, there's Bob Dylan, the folk singer, the first recordings, you know, where it's not his own work. And then the kind of political work that he's doing where he's already speaking in other voices. I wouldn't count that necessarily as part of soft Bob. But once he gets into the songs that are not topical in the same way, you see a lot of vulnerability, boyishness, kind of an unformed. Mm. He is presenting himself as unformed. And his image at the time was very much that way. You know, very boyish. He called himself a baggy elephant in comparison to Joan Baez, who after he and Suze broke up, you know, became his partner in everything. And Joan Baez, this kind of queen, you know, she was a formidable force and a very powerful charismatic star. She was on the cover of Time magazine, and she became Bob's mentor as well as his lover and friend. And, you know, he's just a shambolic. You've watched those scenes where she kind of ushers him out on stage and they sing together. And he really is very floppy in his persona at the time. Nothing is sharpened. Things get a little sharper once he goes to England. Yeah. But the soft Bob is the first Bob that we know personally.
Well, that occurred to me as well. When you were saying that, you're quoting Joan Baez, when she was saying that initially she wanted to mother Dylan because he was so fragile. Yes. And then I'd start to think, when he gets to England in May 65, he's like a teenager who wants to leave home. And he's not,
oh my God.
He's not playing, he's not treating her like that anymore.
No, you know? It's brutal. I mean, I remember the first time I saw Don't Look Back, and I was just, you know, simultaneously, of course, entranced by this charismatic star who's emerging, this completely attitudinal young guy. And I saw that movie, I think, when I was in college. So, you know, that it really attracted me. But then just horrified at the way he treats her, you know, in that film where she's kind of like hanging around and, you know, he's already with Sarah. That's not on screen, but he's rejecting Joan. And it's quite, it's quite a demonstration of, but I mean, is it misogynistic? The way he treats her, it certainly is misogynistic. Put Joan in where the gin is. Misogynistic. Okay. I mean, yeah. It's cruelty above and beyond. And I think one interesting thing to think about that with Dylan is someone who's always aware of his image, and particularly in that film where you have the kind of, you know, very neo-realist, you know, feeling of the film, but he's always aware of the camera being on him. And I think he's taking cues at that time from English rock stars who, honestly, especially the Stones, kind of treat their women in a similar way at that time, right? So you have, if Mick Jagger is a big model for Bob Dylan at the time, and I know everyone talks about John Lennon and their connection with the Beatles, but think about the Stones too, and Brian Jones. I mean, Mick Jagger was the king of, like, I will toss you away, little girl. You know, that was all his early songs are full of that. I mean, you know, I'm seeing a lot of that in that moment with Dylan. And, you know, he's equally dismissive of Donovan, who is sort of like the soft boy Bob doesn't want to be anymore.
So I think also, true. I mean, now that I think about it, it's not just Dylan who's being misogynistic towards Joan Baez in Don't Look Back, but there's a kind of male gang of Dylan, Bobby Newworth, Alan Price, and D.A. Pennebaker, because the way she exits from that film, she almost exits from that film because she's been pressured out. And that last shot of her going out the door, it's quite nasty. And it is quite male, and it is quite misogynistic, I think.
Yes, you know what always amazes me is that Bob, you know, gets back with her a number of times over the years to perform. And that she gets back with Bob as well.
Well,
and just they're singing together, you know, in Rolling Thunder, just watching them singing together is great because it's so multi-layered. It's so dangerous. Every moment of it is sort of dangerous, even when they're supposed to be like, well, there's never really a moment, is there, where they're sort of buddies again?
Well, there's that guarded scene in Rolling Thunder and slash Ronaldo and Clara when she's saying you went and got married, scene. You know, and he's saying thought will fuck you up and all that bit. And it's that kind of has the air of estranged friends, doesn't it?
Yes. I mean, I think that she's talked about how they, you know, it's not like they were constantly in touch, but they were inconsistently, but forever more in touch, I think. And they're just connected. I mean, I feel like they are artistic sister, brother, twins in a way. So he couldn't give that up. Plus, you know, he's a player. He's going to have more than one, you know? So the Rolling Thunder stuff it's hilarious to me how he staged these scenes. And even Sam Shepard in the Rolling Thunder Diary writes about the craziness of those scenes with Sarah and Joan and, you know, Bob's like, being literally torn asunder by the two of them. Well, every man's dream, right, guys? You know, who's directing this movie?
Well, is that the period that you call, is it Naked Bob? Or
I think that's the Star Body, but yeah, that's where he gets naked because he's like showing off his, you know, he's in that kind of scarfy, show off my chest a little bit, you know, I'm, and he is, I mean, the Rolling Thunder footage, you see more of his body than you normally do. There is I included in my multimedia show with a talk, you know, an image of him from Woodstock, I think, where he's like jumping into a pool. So it's not like we've never seen in swim trunks, but so it's not like we've never seen his body. But when you think about like the mod body of Bob Dylan that was very sort of influenced by, I think, the early Stones, it's very buttoned up, you know, it's like collar all the way, you know, buttoned up all the way to the neck. But then it's the 70s, man, you know, everybody's getting loose. And it's interesting because during that period, he starts working with women and collaborating with women more on Rolling Thunder. Joni joins the tour. Roberta Flack played a date. Scarlett Rivera is a huge part of that period. And then Desire and Emmylou. I mean, to me, I have always loved that record. And what I love the most about it is the way that Emmylou Harris's voice and her the intensity of her singing is just pushing him to do things with his voice that he's never tried to do before. Sometimes to a fault, one might say, but I enjoy it.
Oh, me too. And we had Rob Stoner on this podcast last year, and he was, you know, reminding us that most of Emmylou Harris's contribution to that album is one session And it's about 70% of the album. And most of them are early takes. And on one of them, she's saying, I fucked it up. She's not happy with it. She's feeling her way around the notes, but it's absolute gold.
It's totally. I mean, there's no harmony singer. There's no duet partner like Emmy Lou. I mean, that's just like her work with Graham Parsons, obviously, which, you know, really rocketed her to stardom and remains legendary. But then her more recent work, and even, I guess, since the 80s with Rodney Crowell, I think she remains just this incredible. And let's not forget her work in trio with Dolly and Lynn Ronstadt. She's just a master at catching the vibe of who she's with, and not just like floating along with that vibe, but then pushing the edge of her partner so that whoever she's singing with goes to that next place. And that's what happens with Dylan, I think, on that record.
And ironically, she was all set to be a Joan Baez clone, and then she met Grant Parsons, heard some George Jones, you know, and that was that.
Yes. Actually, speaking of which, I was reading your excellent book, Good Booty, about love and sex in American music. And so I was just reading it, and I paid particular attention to the 60s, 70s, because that's sort of, you know, a place where I remain fixated in a lot of ways. And I read about Janis Joplin.
Yes.
Having a Joan Baez voice
that
she never got to use.
Yes.
Back in her, I guess she was, you know, a folky strumming away. And then she started hanging around with the Electric Boys of Big Brother and couldn't be heard singing like Joan Baez.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really fascinating.
Well, you know, she started on the coffee house circuit in Austin and at Threadgill's. And when she came out to California, she did get in with this crowd that was playing super loud. I think we forget, you know, what that music sounded like, early psychedelic music, how much it was like punk in a lot of ways. And honestly, how much it was like the Velvet Underground. But, you know, I mean, Lou Reed, RIP, would probably, you know, object to me saying this. But there's a kind of cacophony in those early bands like Big Brother, Moby Grape, bands like that, Jefferson Airplane.
Well, Jefferson Airplane were very acoustic when they started, weren't they?
At least
there's quite a bit of acoustic on the first album.
They were when they started, but then it just gets kind of crazy. And Big Brother, especially, I mean, they were just bashing away at their instruments. So she also was very interested in the blues and was trying to figure out how to make that, what she heard in the blues, her own, like how to transubstantiate the blues, you know, through her own voice. I was just rereading this amazing essay by Margot Jefferson that is a classic essay. It's called Ripping Off Black Music. Do you know that essay?
No.
And it's one of the first accounts from 1973 about how white artists appropriate black music. It's like very intense. Margot Jefferson is a great American critic. She is black. The entire history of American music, she cites the appropriation that goes on from Elvis to everyone else.
Right.
She ends her essay with Janis, and she says, the thing about Janis is she went through that appropriation and ended up herself. But she also died that death, you know? So you have to ask, what was the cost? I'm not sure if I believe that Janis died for her music or because of her music. I think her death was a tragic accident in many ways, but it is arguable that the role that she had to play in the culture that the industry, music industry and the culture kind of slotted her into as this excessive woman, you know, supported or made necessary her addictive tendencies, you know, and that contributed to her death. I say similar things about both Jimi Hendrix and Jim Morrison. As you know, like in every case, these artists were cast as liberators, you know, liberating us from, you know, Americans from racist divides, you know, Hendrix transcending race supposedly, or Jim Morrison like acting out this caricature of masculinity that supposedly broke on through to the other side of it. But in every case, they were caught in the trap of racism and sexism and ultimately couldn't transcend. And I think that's the tragedy of all three of those figures.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting. You do, in Good Booty, Bob doesn't show up a lot, and I'm kind of interested in that. But one of the times that he does show up is you compare him and Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah.
And yes. You say actually that, although you don't use the word Jufro, I think you say, I can't remember what you say, but it is a Jufro that he had. And that Jimi Hendrix took his afro from Bob's Jufro, which I thought, really, did that happen? But of course, it was there before Jimmy's. Yeah.
So, as Roger Waters later called it, the obligatory Hendrix perm, you know, and I think it's Dylan, really. Eric Clapton had a bit in cream, didn't he, for a while?
But
it's Dylan, and when you talk about Dylan's head, before his body really kind of played a part, it's the head, it's the brain, it's that massive frizzy hairdo, isn't it, that's so kind of encapsulating and entrancing.
Yes. No, definitely. I mean, that's one of the fun things about looking back at the 60s and 70s, too, is the way that the artists were collaborating with photographers and album designers. And, you know, now, you know, we kind of live in a multimedia age and we have artists that are constantly giving us images via the internet. But then it was these collaborations with these image makers and still photography that really, you know, made the image. And I think you see that with Dylan a lot. I think you see that with Hendrix too. And, you know, one thing I want to say about Hendrix's look is, I don't know if y'all have ever heard of this woman named Devin Wilson, but I want to recommend a great book by Maureen Mann that came out this year called Black Diamond Queens that recasts the history of rock and roll by recentering Black women. And she has a chapter on Black women who were companions of rock stars. So Devin Wilson was one. She and Hendrix were together in the very early years before he came to London in New York. And she was a big contributor to his image. And I think she was looking at, she's in New York, so she's probably seeing Dylan and like seeing what a style icon he was at that time and saying, hey, Jimmy, you know, grow your hair out a little bit.
because they wanted to put him into mohair suits, didn't they? I think Chaz Chandler wanted him to get into a mohair suit. And he said.
And that was like, you know, again, managers were so important, just like the photographers, you know, just like with Dylan, Daniel Kramer, his images of Dylan were so important, you know, that managers also, Abercrombie. I mean, those are the important people that shaped the image of these stars. So,
but I was speaking of important women. I was also, you made a lot of really interesting points about Janis and Jimmy. And one of them was that Janis had longstanding relationships, a couple of them with women, longer standing relationships than she had with men.
Yes.
And that back then, in that time when everything was everybody was letting it all hang out and being very groovy, you couldn't really properly be gay if you were that way inclined.
It's true. And I was, turning that back to Dylan, like thinking about the way he talks about sexuality in his music, which one of the points of Bob Dylan's Body essay is that he does talk about sexuality in his music, although he doesn't talk about his own body or what he looks like very often. You're not going to get a WAP. There's no wet anything Dylan. You're not going to get a Megan Thee Stallion moment with Dylan. But what you do get is like these expressions of desire. There's an album called Desire, these expressions of hunger. But it all is a lot of longing, a lot of kind of like drive toward women, a lot of assertion of mastery.
I want you.
I want you so bad. Exactly. So bad.
But there isn't much more than that, is there? Or there's tons of subtext, isn't there?
Well,
but
what I was going to say is like connecting with your point about queerness is like, a question I ask is like, can we queer Dylan? And my jury's still out on that. You know, I think I make the comparison of the soft Dylan and as you said, like a lesbian couple, but his lyrics are pretty conventionally patriarchal, you know, and pretty conventionally straight and heteronormative. So, you know, when I was a kid, I wrote the lyrics to Love Minus Zero, No Limit on the back of an envelope. And I put it in this hurricane glass I had that my mom had brought back from Pat O'Brien's, the famous bar in New Orleans. And I kept that on my dresser for years, you know, and I just would pull it out sometimes and look at it. And to me, that was like the ideal expression of what a woman should be. Like, this is what Bob Dylan wants in a woman, you know? And I thought about reading those lyrics today, but I wrestle with them now because they are so, they're beautiful. I mean, they're truly beautiful. You know, a bird with a broken wing at the window, you know, et cetera. but it's also like a very silent, kind of passive, receptive image of a woman. And that's not who I, you know, want to be. And that's not who I think, that's not what I want women to want to be when they, you know, when they fall in love with an artist. Like, and I was looking through like Sad Eyed Lady of the Lowlands or Sarah, you know, so these beautiful love songs he writes. And again, it's still like, you know, he calls in Sarah, he calls Sarah a virgin and, you know, mystical wife, even though she's like had how many of his kids by then, you know?
She's no virgin, Bob. Come on.
Yeah. But also,
she was,
I mean,
divorced when you met her.
It always, it interests me that I'm Blood on the Tracks, you know, when he's talking about his relationships, he says, mine have been like Verlaine's and Rambo. Now that is not, if we're talking about queerness, that is not a patriarchal image.
I think that Blood on the Tracks is the beginning, and maybe it's a singular case, but it's the beginning of him opening up to this other way of thinking about women and thinking about relationships as more equal. And he's been humbled, you know, and there's a kind of humility in that. Now he goes right back, you know, by desire. He's like, we're waxing macho again. But then when he enters into the Christian phase, it's interesting because there's a relationship with God that's like complicated and he's being vulnerable again. And then jump ahead, by the time we get to Time Out of Mind, and he's very vulnerable in those songs. You know, like in a song like Lovesick, he's extremely vulnerable. So I'm not, you know, the Verlaine and Rambo lyric has always puzzled me in some way.
Do you know the play Total Eclipse by Christopher Hampson?
No.
That tells the story of Verlaine and Rambo. And I think it's mid-70s. I wonder if Dylan was aware of that, because that basically tells their lives in a series of scenes, you know, the arguments basically between those two. And maybe he's alluding to the drama of his life as well as to that.
Well, yeah, maybe, but you know, also I'm going to interrupt you and say, don't forget Allen Ginsberg too, like huge influence on him. And, you know, he did have, I can't find it right now, but in my essay, there's another Paul, what was his name? Folk singer.
Clayton.
Was big. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Was, Clayton. Yeah.
So then he was, okay. So, I mean, I don't know how deep we can go into like the personal, we don't know really biographically.
Well, we do know that Ginsberg and Dylan were very, very close.
Yes, very close. And,
I mean, as more of a mentor, it started out as a mentor. Acolyte thing, and then Ginsberg just became his biggest fan, didn't he?
Exactly. And so there.
But he also learned a lot about Ginsberg's lifestyle, I should think.
Oh yes, I'm sure.
You know, because he hung out with those guys, and they were.
Yeah, I mean,
which was,
know,
I think, very you know, very unusual at the time. For it was such a macho, basic scene. You know, the '60s was still pretty macho, even if you were soft-bodied Bob, to be friends with, you know, a whole coterie, really, of you know, gay people. And taking things, you know, from them, cultural things and references that I think, many references that made it into the songs.
I think we're gaining more knowledge of this now as people are speaking their stories. It's similar to a story that I really want to help tell at some point that people like Dom Flemons are telling, which is the story of Black folk singers and how influential they were on the early part of Bob's career. You know, particularly someone like Len Chandler, who was like one of his best friends early on in New York. And like, I got to meet Len a couple of years ago, and man, that guy's stories, you know, like driving Bob to meet Woody Guthrie, like being the guy who drove Bob, you know, or being at the March on Washington with him. Mm. And this guy is not very written into the story at all. Mm. And there were others on the scene, you know, Odetta as like his initial influence. So I think that we're in a moment where all of these stories are emerging, and maybe Paul Clayton's story, maybe is there a good book on Bob and Alan? Because that would be a great subject for a book, you know. Somebody get out there, write that book. Because we need another Bob Dylan book, because it's not like there aren't like 4,000 of them.
Are there any coming out this year, I wonder?
Let's agree to make the 81st birthday the Ginsberg Dylan book.
Yes!
Would you say, Anne, that, I mean, talking about queerness and things, would you say that Dylan is rock music's first androgyne? I mean, I always thought that kind of mid-60s blonde-on-blonde era dandy harlequin kind of plugged straight into Bowie. But then you in your piece, you talk about the androgynous era before that, the puppy fat lesbian couple era that we should call it.
I entertained your thought for a moment, and then the ghost of little Richard ran up behind me and yelled, "That's my place! You get out of my place right now!" Girl.
So, you're in a good booty, absolutely.
I think we had, I mean, and Elvis too was very androgynous, you know, and Greil Marcus had really, like, Mystery Train had opened my eyes to, like, thinking about music in these different ways. And through mythologies and stuff, and there was an essay in this collection that talked about Elvis as a woodland faun, a mythical creature. And it just went ding, ding, ding in my head of like, oh yeah, Elvis is this kind of like delicate creature, even though he's also very sexy. And, you know, he was always so soft. And Bobby Ann Mason writes about this too in her great little book on Elvis, that, you know, he was a mama's boy and he had that softness about him. And there's a softness to Southern men sometimes too, I think, white American Southern men. Yeah. So I think androgyny was always there, but Dylan, I don't know. He takes it to a different place for sure. You know,
Speaking of taking things to a different place, there's one thing you said about Lay Lady Lay, just to sort of go into another period that we haven't talked about.
Yeah.
The Nashville period.
Yeah.
And you call the song Dylan's successful entry into the soft rock, soft porn sweepstakes taking place on turn of the 70s FM radio.
Yes, one of my favorite.
I mean, I've heard the Isaac Hayes version. Obviously, that really does take it there. But I'm interested though, because I never sort of heard it like that as a young teenage boy hearing it for the first time. I just thought it was a beautiful love song. But
wow.
Go. Soft rock, soft porn. Go.
Well, this is something I write about in Good Booty, and it was one of my favorite, one of the funnest areas to research. But, you know, the early 70s, when soft rock came into vogue, early, mid-70s, and it continued into the, obviously, all the way into the 80s, yacht rock, as it's called now. At the same time, hard rock was getting more, like, explicitly sexual, too. You had Robert Plant, basically kind of like in a distant duet with Donna Summer with the moaning and the groaning and all that's happening. I theorize that this is all happening in part because of the rise of the mainstreaming of pornography. And this interesting thing that happened, which is like porn movies previous to this era had been stag films without soundtracks. Like there was just music. And so now you heard sex as well as saw sex when you went to see a porno, right? So, and this is the moment when Linda Lovelace, you know, all those movies are in Deep Throat. They're all in the theaters and people are going to see them. Mainstream American couples. I don't know what's happened over all y'all's side of the pond, but, you know, here, like mom and dad, we're going to sneak out in the afternoon and go see The Devil and Miss Jones or whatever. So they're hearing sex. So you start to hear that in music. And what happens in soft rock is it's not so much the moaning and groaning of hard rock and disco, but it's sort of these very lovely, almost instructional songs about having sex, you know? And the same thing happened in country, which is interesting. I think, you know, circling back to talking about Blood on the Tracks again, country music is the other big influence on that record. And he's spent time in Nashville, obviously, working with the Nashville Cats and, you know, meeting Nashville songwriters. And I think someone like Kris Kristofferson was, you know, really making an impression on Dylan. So, you know, you had Help Me Make It Through the Night, Take the Ribbon from Your Hair, and
Lay Across My Big Brass Bed. Yeah.
Yeah. But I'm also thinking about, you know, Afternoon Delight and songs like that. So, you know, you have songs that are basically like, we're just going to talk about the fact that we are having sex. It's not going to be metaphor or euphemism. Well, Afternoon Delight is a metaphor, but it's pretty out there. And that's how I always felt about Lay, 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 Lay. It's like, he's just laying it down, as you might say, as he's laying her down on the bed. But, you know, I was thinking about, I almost read those lyrics too, because I thought it would have been hilarious if I read those lyrics in this Victorian tone. But it could be a Kris Kristofferson song.
Yeah.
You know, that's
just from the other side, just I'm thinking about instructional songs now. Have you heard Candy Staten doing a song called Do Your Duty?
Oh, yes. Oh, my God.
You,
so
what you're
good.
Supposed to do. Do what you know you've got to do. Do your duty.
I love her so much. Me too. Oh, my God. Me I love too. Candy Staten. Yeah. Me too. Because that was the other, I mean, it was certainly funk and soul and women, you know, women artists like Candy or Chaka Khan. I mean, when I was a kid, Tell Me Something Good by Rufus was like the first song that I recognized was about sex. And like, tell me that you like it. What is it? What is it? You know, I mean, obviously, I figured out what it was. And thus, my
speaking of
life was
speaking life. Of it, I was looking for a Prince segue.
Oh, there we go.
Right, there we go. Just because he wrote a song called "It," I believe, didn't he? Yeah. And do it all the time. It. And, but you have some sort of Prince project going. I've just been, you know, stalking you on the interweb, and I saw that you said you went to Prince's house once. Or
oh, that was years ago. I interviewed Prince. It was like one of the high points of my life, and it continues to be one of my most popular articles I ever wrote. Right. And in fact, I'm working on a little BBC program in which I sort of reminisce about that, another sort of my life journey with Prince's music. Because Prince is like I was going to say he's my Dylan, but that's not true, because Dylan is my Dylan. But he is an artist that I think has sort of defined and influenced my worldview as much as I definitely put Prince up there with U2. I love U2. That was a very important band for me, especially as a young person. And Madonna, you know, I have these artists that are so important to me. Maybe Polly Harvey is another one. But Prince, you know, here's something I think Prince and Dylan share. They create worlds, you know. They create worlds. They are world builders. I don't know if either of you are into sci-fi, but there's a lot of talk in sci-fi and fantasy about world building and how important that is. Like, or think about Game of Thrones, where every detail, every like stroke of the pen, like adds another detail in the world. And I think Dylan does that in his work. And I think that's something Prince does. And as a, you know, such a reader and a nerd, I think that's what I love the most about these artists. I can immerse in their world. Oh, Kate Bush is my other, how could I forget you, Kate? She's my other world building artist that really defined kind of what I love about music.
And they all have massive hair. All these people have massive hair. Prince, Little Richard, Bob Dylan, well, Kate
I
Bush.
I also have massive hair. So.
Actually, Joni never had massive hair. I don't think. I mean, she did go through a ringlet phase, didn't she? I think maybe
she
in the
did
90s.
In the 80s. Joni, in the 80s. Joni, it's interesting because I always loved Joni, but it's only been in recent years that I've immersed myself in her work. So I kind of approached her later in my life. And I'm glad because I have less baggage about her, like in terms of my fandom for her. As a critic, I think I can see her work in a, I'm not going to say more clearly, but maybe more clearly. Like I don't have adolescent associations with her music the way I do with these other artists. Mm. But I will say something really immersing in Joni and then going back to the Kate Bush albums that made me completely obsessed with Kate Bush when I was like 18 years old. I can hear so much Joni on those records. And I never knew that. Like I had never really spent that much time listening to the first two Joni records, Song to a Seagull, for example. Kate, she just like, the singing is so similar. It's pretty wild. But then Kate finds her ground by the dreaming and becomes the magnificent goddess that she remains to this day.
Did you ever get a chance to ask Prince about, I'm not sure what you were there to interview him about, but we know he was a huge Joni fan.
Yeah.
Did you ask him about Joni? Because
I didn't, because we were that wasn't something we were talking about that for that particular interview. But yeah, he loved Joni. He recorded the best cover of A Case of You I've ever heard. You know, they were in dialogue with each other. I think they knew each other a little bit. They were mutual admirers of each other. And I think what he loved about Joni was her musicality. You know, it's not so much, she's not a world builder like those other artists. She's more of a traveler. I think of traveling as a great metaphor to describe what Joni does. She moves through the world and describes it and has insight into it versus like, I am going to create a world that you are in. But musically, I think she and Prince share a lot. You know, they're endlessly inventive, endlessly curious, endlessly challenging the very song structures of pop. And I think he heard that in her music.
As I said, when we started out, I love his little jokes. And I was listening to Dirt Road Blues today, so it came up on the shuffle. And I thought, that's actually, the music in it is funny. You know, that sort of the cheesy organ is, on, that's funny. And the guitar, they've got the guitars tuned to sound a bit like kazoos.
Yes.
You know, it's like, and it, to me, it's just, you know, it's another one of his miserable blues songs, but it's still very funny.
Well, I don't want to completely attribute this to Bob's Jewishness, but I am in a Jewish family. My husband is Jewish and our child has been raised Jewish. And, you know, I think a great aspect of Jewish art is that it like weaves together humor and cosmic pondering and, you know, deep thoughts. And those things are never separable. You know, I mean, there's always the punchline, you know, there's always the joke. If you think about, I don't know, Philip Roth comes to mind, for example, you know, someone who is really on people's mind right now. There's been a new biography of him out, but yeah, this is just something, or I don't know, Sarah Silverman. I could grab a million people examples. But I think Dylan's humor is very Jewish in a way. You know, it has there's a spiritual dimension to it, and it's a little bit fatalistic, but it's also just like it's going for the laugh, you know? It's both things at once. So, but I love that about Bob. There's not a song. I don't know if you could find a song, maybe Love Minus Zero, No Limit, where there isn't a joke. You know, most songs, like you were talking about Simple Twist of Fate at the beginning of this episode, there's that line about the parrot that talks that makes us laugh. There's always a joke next to the heartbreak, intertwined with the heartbreak.
Is It Rolling, Bob? Talking Dylan is recorded on Zencaster, stuck inside Immobile.
Engineered by Mark Langley Smith and produced by Robin Guise. Digital imaging by Finn Guise. Music is by Sam Hare.
We're part of Pantheon Podcasts, the music podcast network.
Find us on Twitter at IsItRollingPod.
I don't want to straight face you, race or chase you, track or trace you, or disgrace you, or displace you, or define you, or confine you. All I really want to do is, baby, be friends with you.